Good afternoon. I'm Charles Berry, the chairman of the board of the New York Society Library, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today. Before I hand things over to Connie Roosevelt, I'd like to just express a couple of words of thanks. First to Connie herself, who has been a wonderful stalwart of the committee, I believe since the very beginning, and this is the 14th award ceremony that we've had. Connie is going to be stepping down as the chair, and I just can't thank her enough for all that she's done over these many years. So thank you very much, Connie. And I'd also like to recognize and thank Roger Pasquier, who is going to be stepping in as the chair of the jury. Thank you, Roger. It'll be great to have you doing that. And then finally, I'd like to recognize Ellen Eisenman, who, with her brother Frederick, is sponsoring this evening's event. It's wonderful to have that sponsorship, and it's terrific to have everybody here today. So without more, I'll hand it over to Connie. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles, and hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I want to second your thank you to Ellen, because we are deeply honored to have been underwritten this year. Thanks very much. I also want to take a minute to say a word about the book jury. Working with the jury makes me realize what an extraordinary pool of talent we have at the library. Library membership is not a requisite of being a member of the jury, but it just so happens that this year everyone who's on the jury is a library member. It was not done intentionally. But when I was thinking about it, I suddenly realized that out of the five of our authors, four have books that were published last year altogether. Meg Wolitzer and Ellen Feldman are novelists who between them have written 24 novels. The 10-year Nap by Meg and Scottsboro by Ellen were published last year, and both of them got really excellent reviews. I think Ellen right now is being feted by the Guggenheim Foundation as one of their new fellows, and Meg, I think, is here and should be recognized. But in any event, Cynthia Salzman is an art historian whose latest book, Old Masters and New World, was also published last year to great acclaim, Cynthia. And Leighton McCartney, who writes a lot about American history, also published a book last year on the Teapot Dome scandal, which was very highly acclaimed. You could get tired of this, as a matter of fact, but we have Betsy Barlow Rogers, who is known more popularly as Mrs. Central Park, and has written 6 books on landscape history, and a wonderful newsletter, which I just, it's a joy to read on the subject. And let's see, Barbara Cohen is a publisher of books. She's published as many books as we've written, our jury has written, at least, about New York City. And Roger Pasquier, who you know is going to be chair next year, and Lucien Bloch both have full-time careers, but they managed to read enough books to win marathons. It's just extraordinary. I don't know what we'd do without you. So I want to thank everyone on the jury. I deeply appreciate the amount of work that you all have done and the good judgment that you've shown. Now, the most exciting part, I get to introduce Christopher. Christopher actually was my predecessor as chair of the jury, I have to say, and we had a field day when he was here. We still follow all of his rules and regulations. Rigorously, I know, exactly. And I love being able to welcome him back to make this presentation. He's completely appropriate person to be doing it. He recommended Gail to us first, and he is an architecture, a chronicle of architecture in this city that writes a regular column for the New York Times called Streetscapes and has written a book of the same title. And all in all, he's the perfect person to present the award. So, Christopher.
Indeed, it is. Sounds like it's publisher Parrish on the book jury, doesn't it? And so I left, and thus I'm still alive. The Woolworth Building is one of the most iconic of New York's structures, and it has no more abler chronicler than Gail Fenske. If you think you know everything about New York buildings, which people often say I do, if you think you know everything about this very familiar landmark, then this is the book for you, which is so riveting. Due date, December 16th, 2008. Jeez. You know, whoever had this book out is really in trouble. Oops. Particularly riveting are to see the complex personal interplay between owner and architect, that is Frank Woolworth and Cass Gilbert, on such a huge effort at $13 million. By this time, a single owner working at such a level was really unusual. The level of investment required to build the really big buildings in New York had brought in corporations and investment groups and had displaced the single owner. So you rarely get something with an individual stamp as you got with Frank Woolworth and his Woolworth Building. So great was the pressure. Oh, so every decision here was really handmade by Frank Woolworth or Cass Gilbert themselves or their people. So there's a lot of personality in the Woolworth Building. So great was the pressure, Frank Woolworth had fits of weeping during construction. His architect, Cass Gilbert, started talking in his sleep. Gilbert's wife, Julia, found her husband's client unpolished. Can you imagine that? This dream client comes along and the wife doesn't get along? And she disdained his bad grammar, and this is the best part, his nickel and dime vocabulary. You know, that's like sticking the knife in and kind of giving a little twist. The New York Society Library is very privileged to give this year's book award to Dr. Gail Fenske for The Skyscraper in the City, The Woolworth Building, and The Making of Modern New York. Excuse me, where is the award?
Oh, I think there's something over here. Let me play Vanna White for you.
Congratulations and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm just really honored to be here. It's a pleasure to meet others who share my interest in New York City. It's also an honor to receive this award, and especially from an institution as old and as distinguished as this one. For me, the very idea of the New York Society Library and its collections calls to mind the history of the city itself. Not only do I think of the first Library of Congress, which is amazing, but I also imagine the collections here as a layered record of the city's culture and history that's not unlike the layering of its terrain, which is my subject of study. I can't help but hear voices of scholars and poets and essayists and novelists, the people of the past who've invested these layers in the city with depth and meaning. I'm in reverence of authors like Herman Melville and Willa Cather, who worked here, and others who frequent the library over time. So it's inspiring for me to share a piece of this history, even a small history. It's a marvelous history. But the reason I'm here is the book itself, The Skyscraper in the City. So I thought I'd just say a few words about the book, why I wrote it, and what it meant to me. I wrote this book, first of all, because I've always been interested in skyscrapers. As long as I can remember, I've been interested in skyscrapers. I see them as the most visible signs of human endeavor. I'm intrigued by the stories, and in particular by the people like Woolworth and Gilbert, behind their design and construction. I've always been curious about why they were built. But this particular skyscraper, the Woolworth Building, especially intrigued me. From the first time I saw it in photographs, I was puzzled, really puzzled, by how such a technologically audacious work of construction, built at a time when technology, building technology, was at the forefront of things, built in the chief metropolis, the nation's chief metropolis, on a highly visible site. This audacious work, nearly 800 feet tall, the tallest in the world, should look like a cathedral. Why? Why does it look like a medieval building when it's so exciting and so new and record-breaking? So I was interested in that contradiction. between its ambitious modern construction and the retrospectiveness and the romance of its imagery. And so I thought that that demanded some sort of explanation. I sensed it'd be a cultural explanation, and I sensed it would be complex. So that was the question guiding my work. How do you explain this cathedral of commerce in cultural terms? And that kept me intrigued over the many years I spent writing the book. But I think it's important to note that when one writes a book like this, you don't want to lose sight of the building itself. The building, for me, was absolutely at the center of this. I was very interested in the fact that in the eyes of contemporaries, this building enhanced their experience of the city, especially at the height of its popularity in the 1920s. And for me, this suggested the importance of urban aspirations to its creators. But what was that experience? If you approach the Woolworth Building on the sidewalk, you see shops and show windows. These set up a path. They lead you straight to this Tudor Gothic portal on the central axis of the tower. You step inside, and you see this dazzling Romanesque lobby arcade, something rivaling the scale of a cathedral, a brilliance of color, although these are original and old black and white images. You must imagine this being very colorful. Sparkling Byzantine mosaics, gilded Gothic tracery, variegated marble. You look ahead and you see a flight of stairs. They rise up to Irving National Exchange Bank. Just underneath that stair, there's another stair that takes you down through bronze gates, large bronze gates, to the platforms of both the IRT and the BRT subway lines, which had just been built. If you wanted to do some more sightseeing, you could take a high-speed elevator up to the tower's pinnacle observatory, stand in the octagonal peaks encircling balcony, and take in a panoramic view of the city. So those who experienced the Woolworth Building, especially during its height of popularity in the 1920s as a tourist destination, were more than merely observers. They had become rather active participants in an experience, a modern social, spatial, visual dynamic which involved the urban surroundings in complex ways. So for me, such an experience of the skyscraper, connected as it is with the experience of the city, raised questions about this building's relationship to its historic urban setting. It was hard to sum up that setting, of course. New York is impossible. It's impossibly complex. But I could find a few, I thought, important themes. Around 1900, New York was the nation's chief metropolis. But even earlier, it had been developing a vigorous commercial culture, and I think you can see evidence of that here. This is Ladies' Mile. Already by the 1870s, 1880s, we have these emporiums of consumer enticement encouraging the development of new forms of display, spectatorship. So there's this commercial culture, and there's a set of values that we identify with that, and they had already in the 1870s been inscribing themselves in the city's built environment, these values of spectatorship and display, advertising. There's a kind of out-of-door spectacle that we're seeing here, promenaders interacting with display windows, with the commodities those windows feature, with advertisement. During the same years, right around the same time, the city's printed news media rose to a new level of prominence in city life. So we see in the 1870s and 1880s, this is actually a view of City Hall Park, a vast increase, a 40-fold increase in news production. And, of course, this is on account of newly mechanized printing processes, cheap wood pulp-based paper, but we see this. The media is expanding prodigiously. And then by 1900, daily newspapers began using just equally revolutionary techniques for producing works of graphic art, such as photo engraving. And so we now have a wide reading audience, a kind of mass audience, participating in a visual culture, a visually, in a sense, spectacularized metropolitan culture. If you think of the world at this time, the world on Sunday, it's very colorful, it's spectacular. And so we see an architecture that parallels that. We're actually seeing Pulitzer's World Building at City Hall Park, and actually this is a tinted, it's a kind of a color lithograph. This is the process used for this postcard. But the World Building was even more colorful than what you're seeing here, red, buff, and gray, and it's got this gilded Baroque dome. So it's colorful as the graphics of its newspaper eventually become. And there's a lot of competition, a long newspaper row. These newspapers, the Tribune is competing with the World. They're competing for the Spectator's attention, and they are investing this new publishing industry with an exciting profile in a very densely populated region of the city. And you see people watching for the latest news on bulletin boards. Around the century's turn, I think one distinctive aspect of the visual character of the city was construction. It was as if the city was constantly under construction with large-scale works of engineering. You're seeing Williamsburg Bridge by the photographer Alvin Langdon Coburn on your left. But it's not only the bridges. There was also the subway system that was built at this time, a vast subway system extending the length of the island, tunnels, the great railway stations, Pennsylvania Station, Grand Central. So you can imagine within these short few years at the beginning of the century that this must have been quite amazing, these large works of engineering also being built with an unprecedented rapidity, very, very quickly. And so we're seeing awe-inspiring works of engineering of a large scale being built, modern works of engineering, and this was paralleled by a kind of social modernization. We're expanding immigration at this time, and this leads to, of course, greater ethnic heterogeneity. They're sharpening class divides. There are people who are becoming very, very wealthy, but then there are these new immigrants in the Lower East Side. So I think photographers like Coburn and Alfred Stieglitz, and then painters like George Bellows and the Ashcan School. We're seeing Bellows' New York on the right of 1911, aimed to illustrate in realistic terms this new urban condition. It was a condition of perpetual change. And we get the sense that these artists are struggling to make sense of a city that is unintelligible, you know, and discontinuous due to these forces of change. In 1904, and it's a well-known quote from Henry James, but he confronted the skyscrapers of Lower Manhattan and described New York's mood of the moment, an expression of things lately and currently done, done on a large and personal stage and on the basis of inordinate gain. He, in a sense, had discovered an equally prominent but less tangible aspect of this culture of change. We do call it modernity. It's these unbridled forces of capital, a kind of atmosphere of instability. And for James and others, the new heights of skyscrapers, slender towers with crowns that functioned like trademarks, marking a wave of large-scale economic consolidation occurring at this time, represented a city caught in the throes of modernity. Henry Adams wrote that a cylinder had exploded, throwing great masses of stone and steam against the sky, and of citizens crying out that the new forces must at any cost be brought under control. We're seeing photographs by Coburn on your left and Alfred Stieglitz of 1909, both of 1909, showing the kind of starkness and power of this new vertical construction and a city that is caught in the throes of modernity. So for me, the Woolworth Building's contradictory character. It's got this hybrid of fanciful Gothic ornamental features, tracery, tourelles, gables, gargoyles, and finials. But these are cladding technologically audacious steel-framed engineering. And this contradiction embedded in the building itself seemed to me to suggest the jarring discontinuities of the city at this time, the startling proximities, the unpredictability of this dynamic of ceaseless change, and also just the notion that there's a kind of discomfort with it. Critics like Charles Baudelaire, or more recently Marshall Berman, have described a certain type of modern artist who throws himself into the parodies of the past, thereby expressing modernity's sense of inner dichotomy or of living in two worlds simultaneously. So, as New York's largest skyscraper of the early 20th century, and in a sense paradigmatic, certainly the most visible, it seemed to me that this building could be identified with that experience of modernity. So, how do we explain this? I mean, then I became intrigued. I was interested in this idea of modernity. It led me to the story I was wondering who was behind this creation. Who wanted to build such a skyscraper that was on one hand so audacious and on the other so romantic? Who's behind this? And that led me to Frank Woolworth. You see him on the left here, and then Cass Gilbert there on the right. Frank Woolworth, the famous, the founder of the famous chain of 5 and 10 cent stores, and Cass Gilbert, the noted Beaux-Arts architect. And they're here, actually, 1911, vacationing together in Palm Beach. I found that they had very little in common at the outset, at least, other than their entrepreneurial and enterprising ways. They didn't know each other at all. They belonged to different social circles in New York. Woolworth was a member of the Hardware Club, and Gilbert, the Century Association and the Union Club. But what they shared, what they were interested in, what they both shared, was this interest in the sidewalk spectator in New York and how that person, that crowd, that member of the crowd on the sidewalk interacted with their surroundings. For Woolworth, of course, it was commercial. He wanted to take his stores to the people. But for Gilbert, he wanted to do something different. He was a Beaux-Arts architect and believed in architecture as a high art. And he was really hoping that he could make these very fine buildings with rich color and texture and ornament exciting and interesting to these sidewalk crowds. Woolworth, since the beginning of his career, viewed sidewalks as environments conducive to the stimulation of consumer desire. So he sited his stores on in well-traveled locations of towns and cities, and he contrived a number of strategies for heightening the appeal of his commodities to the sidewalk spectator. Besides storefronts and show window displays, these included trademarks and signs. He was known for the fabrication of theatrical store opening extravaganzas, which entertained crowds, at times dazzled them. On the right, you're seeing his first Woolworth building. That's 1901. That's in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He built it to commemorate the founding of his first store in Lancaster. He dedicated it with a showy, celebratory opening extravaganza. It's a very interesting building. It has a Woolworth store on the ground story, a roof garden at the top, and sandwiched in between 4 stories of speculative offices for renting out. So he continued to be ambitious about the growth of his business and how to commemorate that. So in 1910, he decided to build this great skyscraper in New York. At that time, he owned a total of 300 stores, and they had sales of a little over $50 million. And he chose Cass Gilbert as his architect, and he said later that he picked Gilbert because his Minnesota State Capitol, on your left, and United States Custom House were, quote, magnificent and artistic. He appreciated Gilbert's skills with forging identities for a state capitol or for a custom house that were vivid and memorable. Gilbert created these highly pictorial compositions. Again, he's interested in engaging the eye of the sidewalk spectator. So we see buildings rich with variegated granites and marbles and sculpture and ornament. But just as important, Woolworth admired a specific building of Cass Gilbert's, the West Street building, which you see there on the left. He said that he wanted a building, something like the West Street building. It reminded Woolworth of some of the monuments he'd seen in Europe. He had come to appreciate architecture, Gothic architecture in particular, during his many buying trips abroad. He liked the excitement of the verticals of the West Street building and this kind of the beautiful decorative crown at the top. As for Gilbert, shortly after he received the commission for the West Street building, he produced a design on the right of 1905, a 150-story skyscraper that he wished he could build. He wrote to his daughter that the skyscrapers in New York are not tall enough for me. The tallest is only 33 stories. He had just moved to New York. He had just relocated to New York from St. Paul. And he was very ambitious to get major commissions. And I think the city was sort of brought this out, this ambition to build to these unprecedented heights. So it was really interesting to look at the process of design with Woolworth and Gilbert. That, to me, was really intriguing. They first met in April 1910. Woolworth asked that a skyscraper be modeled on the Victoria Tower of the Houses of Parliament in London. Woolworth was now calling his chain an empire of stores. So this is a building, a tower that has associations with the British Empire. But he had also just opened a chain of stores in England. He wanted to impress city crowds, impress his shoppers, with a Gothic image, which Gilbert later put it, was noted for its beauty. Besides, the Victoria Tower would provide Woolworth with a memorable building that would function something like a trademark, in the end, for him, on the lower Manhattan skyline. He especially was keen on distinguishing his building from that of the Singer Tower. His choice of a site at Broadway and Park Place at the southwest corner of City Hall Park ensured high visibility for his skyscraper. He called it a giant signboard that was going to advertise around the world his spreading chain of stores. As Gilbert's design progressed through four distinctive stages, Woolworth became increasingly determined to promote the design. It was going to be a great signboard. Using the theatrics of height, it got taller and taller and taller. It started out as 20 stories. And he combined this with sensational news media publicity, printed media publicity. So it started out at 20 stories. In the end, it became 55 stories, a spectacular feat of engineering, skyscraper Gothic fantasy, and what Woolworth called his world's greatest skyscraper. Those are his words. It was within only 3 weeks of starting the project that Gilbert suggested that the Woolworth Building be the tallest in the world. The question is, you know, which one of these people came up with this idea, and Julia Finch Gilbert said, Gilbert's wife, that they conspired. And so he proposed within 3 weeks the 720-foot tall Scheme 17, he called it, and that's on the right. He later recalled that he was inspired by many medieval civic buildings, secular buildings. He had begun identifying modern commercial New York with the Flemish free trading cities of the Middle Ages, romantically and nostalgically, suggesting an earlier era of merchant autonomy as opposed to New York's early 20th century corporate headquarters of the nation. During the later stages of design, Gilbert and his assistants added to what started out as this secular Gothic repertory of forms, innumerable motifs that they culled from an array of buildings, medieval buildings, many of which were cathedrals. They consulted countless printed images, Antwerp, Rouen, and Malines, from Gilbert's own sketchbooks, and that's Gilbert's sketch on the right, the Benedictine Abbey Church of Saint Ouen in Rouen. And by the end of the 19th century, they were aware that there was this criticism coming from advocates of John Ruskin. There was this ethic of authenticity in criticism that was well articulated at this time that expressed a fear that individuals of artistic genius, like Gilbert, working within a commodity civilization, might turn into acute manipulators of surface effects. But both Woolworth and Gilbert insisted that they conceive the Woolworth Building as a Beaux-Arts masterpiece, not as a cathedral of commerce. And in doing so, they resisted the forces of sensationalism and spectacle that others, and sometimes themselves, identified with New York's commercial setting. Still, on May 7th, 1911, at 12 o'clock noon, Woolworth, determined to promote his project as widely as possible, photographed and copyrighted Gilbert's final design, sent it to New York's major newspapers, The Times, The World, The Herald, The Tribune, The Post, with instructions for simultaneous publication for the sake of impact in their Sunday editions. It was a dramatic unveiling of a Gothic design before a wide newspaper reading public. Very clever showmanship strategy on the part of Woolworth. There was an accompanying headline, Woolworth Building will be world's greatest skyscraper. It was presented as if it were a self-fulfilling prophecy. Woolworth may have contrived with enterprising newspaper men, certainly he was talking to them, to present a grand illusion such as this, a media event. It's an early version. It wasn't called a media event at that time, but that's what they were known as later. With regard to its construction, the Woolworth Building stood at the forefront. It was no less than a record-breaking feat of modern construction. It was built by the builder, Thompson Sterrett, under the leadership of Louis Horowitz, and Horowitz's modern building organization, as he described it. And he also described it as a systematized and rationalized machine that can deliver buildings to their owners in a guaranteed time. This systemized and rationalized machine for construction included 180 structural iron workers who erected and riveted the frame in less than 9 months, setting a new record for speed. Horowitz's methods of rapid construction echoed contemporary obsessions with scientific management, the standardization of time. Woolworth's ambitions to promote the building reached the heights of spectacularity with his contrivance of a breathtaking electrical opening. And you see it here. This is April 24th, 1913. He had the assistance of his director of advertising, Hugh McAdamy. McAdamy exploited New York City Hall Park. It was already a center of the news media and of printed news media publicity as a grand setting for this opening. He enlisted President Woodrow Wilson, who down in Washington, D.C., pushed a button that was wired to the Woolworth Building's power plant. So he's at his desk in Washington, D.C., presses this button, and the 80,000 electric bulbs, their incandescent bulbs, of the interior flashed on at once. The skyscraper leapt into full view as this brilliantly illuminated object against the evening blackness. McAdamy, working for Woolworth, had news of the event flashed by Marconi wireless operators from the Woolworth Tower to the Eiffel Tower and from there to all European capitals. In the following days and weeks, one source estimated that some 2 million words of publicity about Woolworth, the skyscraper, and the event filled American newspapers and magazines. All pointed to a vibrant urban culture of mass spectatorship, which would appreciate an event such as this, even mass entertainment. Woolworth and his skyscrapers competed within this culture as well as triumphed. And in the end, this all pointed to a newly powerful role for the skyscraper. But Woolworth, for all of his ambition to spectacularize with the media and with the opening, really believed that his skyscraper should function as a solid investment in New York urban real estate. New York was overbuilt. Everybody knew this at the time that he built this skyscraper. In fact, he only needed one story for his offices out of the 55 stories, and there was a glut of office space on the market in New York. It was overbuilt. So he said, I'll create land values. I'll just create a building so attractive that it'll be a new center of attraction. It'll outshine other office buildings, and it'll draw other commercial interests into its orbit. It'll induce the city's leading corporate executives and entrepreneurs and professionals to leave less glamorous office buildings and to relocate. He had designed the setting, the skyscraper as a setting for office work, to be sure, but soon enough, the project evolved under his direction into one of the city's most prominent sites for a high style of consumption. It was a city within a city. He would integrate the newest fashionable consumer enticements, an interior shopping arcade, a health club, with a swimming pool, a giant barber shop, a restaurant, a proposed downtown club, a pinnacle observatory. He would provide an evocative architectural setting for his tenants' entertainment and amusement. Seeking to rival, if not surpass, in opulence and sophistication, the most splendid of the city's settings for elite consumption, Woolworth and Gilbert conceived each of the skyscraper's interior spaces independently, with European styles of decoration and furnishings, evocative of old-world opulence and grandeur. The retailer John Wanamaker had featured period rooms in his department stores. These ranged from old Dutch to Louis XVI. And the Hotel Astor enticed patrons with an old New York lobby, American Indian grill room, Flemish smoking room, and Pompeian billiard room. Woolworth fully intended to rival such luxurious spaces as settings for fantasy and social display within the confines of his own ambitious office building. Department store retailers like John Wanamaker said that they aimed to eliminate the store by weaving through it some central ideas. Well, so too did Woolworth attempt to eliminate the office building as an ordinary work environment by weaving through it architectural theatrical settings that fulfilled his imagined tenants' most fantastic consumer longings. Gilbert designed the swimming pool as a Pompeian bath. You see it here. And this was after the skyscraper's rental agent sought his advice regarding which style, Russian, Turkish, which style might have the most appeal to the tenants. Such settings offered, and Gilbert comes back with Pompeian, these settings offered the Woolworth's tenants a respite from the city's grimmer realities. It supported their retreat into secluded and illusory worlds. It also cultivated for those tenants the fantasy of owning the very best in the world. Like the city's finest fashionable consumer enterprises, Woolworth emphasized service. His skyscraper featured the latest electrical, plumbing, ventilating, and fire protection technologies. These culminated over two decades of experimentation with equipping the modern office building. The skyscraper's water supply was especially complicated. It featured six separate systems that could be cross-connected in case of a firefighting emergency. On a Sunday morning in June 1913, the engineer Albert Webster conducted a spectacular test of the skyscraper's fire protection system. Jets of water shot out the tower's 54th story, showering pedestrians from Fulton Street to Broadway with a giant fountain. Webster's aim was both practical and symbolic. He wanted to ascertain how much pressure a fire pump could develop at 780 feet, but he also wanted to demonstrate publicly that the Woolworth had the capacity to quench its own fires without the aid of the ladders and the crews from the city's fire department. Woolworth and Gilbert's attention to such problems of safety contributed to the public perception of the skyscraper as a giant ocean liner sailing an open sea, fully serviced, self-sufficient, and in the face of danger, inviolably secure. Woolworth expected the most fastidious of tenants. He treated those tenants like his store customers as guests. In distilling the entire metropolitan culture, the entire metropolitan experience within his skyscraper, Woolworth demonstrated his faith in New York, which he now called the, quote, world's greatest metropolis. At a certain stage in my study of the building's design, its construction, its publicizing, promotion, celebration, it became clear to me that early 20th century New York was functioning as a kind of stage for Woolworth and Gilbert's ambitious goals. But then if that were the case, who composed the audience for the Woolworth building? This question really intrigued me, and it's complex, and I found it very interesting and impossible to completely explain. But I found that it engaged this building a diverse array of audiences behind or beyond those of Woolworth's managerial hierarchy, his tenants, potential shoppers in his stores. In doing that, it illuminated a complex cultural dynamic existing between this skyscraper, the experience of modernity, and the city itself. For some observers, Gilbert's design served as an asset to New York's Civic Center at City Hall Park. And we see a view of that on the left. In 1914, the architect and city planner, George B. Ford, applauded Gilbert's design as an architectural benchmark in New York's progress towards the city beautiful. He said, it is a remarkable standard for the city to live up to in its future civic art. The artist Joseph Pennell appreciated the vista extolled by Ford. But the president of the borough of Manhattan, Marcus M. Marx, went a step further. He hailed the significance of Gilbert's design to the city's public life. The Woolworth building, Marx believed, might serve as a catalyst in creating a community of citizens. Such inspired good citizens, he added, would be alive to public service, as opposed to being imposed upon by designing bosses, and so might bring about the city pure, the city sound, the city prosperous, the city beautiful. But Marx's imagined political community couldn't have contrasted more sharply with the modern consumption community that in actuality composed Woolworth's shoppers. Woolworth's emphasis had always been on the commercial, but such an emphasis would become especially clear in the F.W. Woolworth and Company's use of Gilbert's design as a trademark, interchangeably and together with the Diamond W trademark that Woolworth had developed in 1895. The image of the Woolworth building as a trademark imprinted on a diverse array of Woolworth's commodities, enticed Woolworth's consumers to join together in a larger, loosely affiliated community defined by the objects that they owned. It also functioned as something of a giant home for that community. In doing so, it stimulated brand loyalty and promoted a new iconography of group identity. For the avant-garde artist John Marin, the Woolworth's verticals signified the modern city's dynamism and futurity. Gilbert did not have to incorporate in his design setbacks. These were later prescribed in the zoning resolution of 1916. So in sidewalk views, the seemingly unstoppable verticals rose straight upward, triumphing over gravity, rising straight up, and then after the tower, higher still. Marin's Woolworth building, number 31, showed the verticals so tense with energy that they seemed to cause the entire mass of the building to fling itself skyward, pushing, pulling, sideways, downwards, upwards, in Marin's words, as if to free itself from the earthbound city of a rapidly disappearing past. And there's a famous story of where Gilbert walked into Stieglitz's gallery 291 and saw Marin's view of his design and then just left, shaking his head, just couldn't understand it, didn't make sense to him. It was the Woolworth's Pinnacle Observatory, a wonder to tourists, that more than any feature firmly established the skyscraper's international renown. By 1916, that observatory drew over 100,000 visitors a year. Such modern elevated viewing experiences celebrated everyday life, as shown by the popular picture postcards sold to the observatory's tourists. But for the city's artists like Alvin Langdon Coburn, they also transcended that everyday life. Coburn photographed New York as if it were a craggy landscape, the year after he produced pictures of Yosemite and Grand Canyon. In his series, New York from Its Pinnacles, Coburn showed the Woolworth Building as viewed from the Singer Tower, rising above swirling plumes of smoke, emanating from the top of surrounding office buildings as if to occupy a separate realm from other buildings. Regardless of Woolworth's objectives, the experience of panoramic viewing from the top of the Woolworth Tower did echo the quickening pace and modernity of life in early 20th century New York. And we see this in Marin's view taken from the top of the building called Lower Manhattan, composing derived from the top of the Woolworth of 1922. Rapid transit was now running the full length of Manhattan Island and to the boroughs beyond. Electric lights and illuminated signs were brightening the city's streets at night. And the modern consumer city had long ago become a vast and efficient emporium for the handling of goods. For the city's white-collar workers, shoppers, spectators, and tourists in turn, experiencing Woolworth's theatrical orchestration of panoramic vision from the tower's pinnacle meant nothing less than participating fully, freely, independently, as part of the crowd, yet starting out from the crowd, in the exhilarating atmosphere of the modern metropolis. As the Woolworth Building neared completion in 1913, so did construction on William Kendall's Municipal Building. Along with the Singer Tower, these towers and others brought a new order in their isolated arrangement to the skyline, the new skyline. A writer for The Independent, the journal The Independent, declared in 1910 that New York, rather than a city beautiful, had become a city majestic. For me, this new skyline constituted the most important aspect of the Woolworth Building's reception, its contribution to the very image of the city. And this was reproduced again and again in photographs and picture postcards. It was the world's first signature skyline. But I had discovered, after considering the complexity of the Woolworth Building's reception, there was a large diversity of interpretations surrounding the building, that it was impossible to control, even though Woolworth and Gilbert and McAdamy, with his publicity machine, had ideas about controlling how this building would be perceived. It was this skyline, the world's first signature skyline, that projected all at once values that were shared by many. So you might have this diversity of perceptions, but this is one thing everybody agreed on, this new skyline. Everybody agreed it was exciting, it was modern, it was glamorous, it was exhilarating, it was the world's first. It's really important to keep that in mind, and it was really the spectacle of the 20th century city. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gail. And I hope everybody will stay and enjoy the food and drink. Thank you.